Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. And welcome to a History of Horror podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. We've already discussed the cinema monster. Germany was more than keen on creating cinematic villains. Nosferatu, or the Somnambulist in Caligari. Indeed, there is a version of the monster within Edison's Frankenstein, which we spoke about in the first episode. Monsters are present early from the start of cinema, and the audiences love them. Take, for example, the almost excessive number of versions of the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The film was popular to make films throughout the first half of the 20th century. The mix of the promise of a dramatic transformation scene and the draw of a strong central performance made it hugely popular with filmmakers and audiences. There are six versions of that story between 1908 and 1931. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which from 1908 was a Selig Polyscope Company silent horror mixture, which starred Herbert Bosworth and Betty Hart in her film debut. It was directed by Otis Turner and produced by William Ed Selig, and had a screenplay adapted by George F. Fish. And it was actually a version on an 1897 four-act stage play. This is something that pops up frequently in our look at horror with scripts that have been transformed from the stage. This massive lengthy play was actually condensed into one reel short. Critics were enthusiastic about it, giving Bosworth special mention. The change is displayed with dramatic ability almost beyond comprehension. Now, for this, really, a lot of the time, one of the reasons why it was so popular was it was kind of like an artistic trick that the actor was able to completely transform their features to become from one, you know, the genteel Jekyll to the gruesome Hyde. And as we've said in terms of this change in sophistication, this is also true with these kind of changes in that story. By 1931, the films were popular still, but had become a lot more sophisticated in their execution. This version was American pre-Coe's horror film, directed by Ruben Mamoulin and starring Frederick Marsh. The film was actually made prior to the full enforcement of the production code, which is a censorship code, basically, which does sit uneasily along this story. Although the focus a lot more was on sex rather than violence. The film is kind of remembered now for being one of those pre-code films that had a heavy layer of sex in it. And there was particularly the character of Ivy Pearson, played by Miriam Hopkins. It was so sexy, in fact, that when it was re-released in 1936, the production code required 8 minutes to be removed before the film could be distributed by theatres. But don't worry, if you wish to have a look now, that footage has been restored for DVD releases.
What you are about to see is a secret you are sworn not to reveal. Now, you who have sneered at the miracles of science, you who have denied the power of man to look into his own soul, you who have derided your superiors, look! Look!
And to give you some idea about how much these the particularly Jekyll and Hyde films were couched in mystery about how the transformation scene was revealed. It was actually kept a secret for decades. The director himself revealed it in the end in a number of interviews with Hollywood directors, published under the title The Celluloid Muse. But that was not for a long time afterwards. How they did it was a great trick and a use of how black and white could be used. Makeup was applied in contrasting colours, and then a series of colour filters were matched the makeup were used, which enabled it to kind of gradually be exposed or made invisible. Because the films are black and white, you can't see the change happening on the filters. But it wasn't just Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for this kind of thing. The concept of a strong lead character and a monster was not just tied to that story. Frank Lon Chaney was an American stage film actor, director and screenwriter. He was known for his versatile and powerful acting roles in early cinema, and kind of specialised in tortured grotesques, people who were afflicted. And he was also known for applying his own makeup to create these monsters. He appears in The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Phantom of the Opera. And his ability to transform himself using his own makeup techniques earned him the nickname The Man of a Thousand Faces. Now, our story will focus on universal monsters, although dalliance in other areas. And this is the first step towards that. The Hunchback of Notre Dame was made in 1923, directed by Wallace Worsley. And it was a Carl Lemille and Irvin Thalberg produced film. It was, despite the fact it was a horror film, Universal's super jewel of 1923, as they called it, and was the most successful silent film, grossing over $3 million. The film is based on Victor Hugo's novel of the same name, and it's noticeable for a few things, but one of them being the grand sets that recall 15th century Paris, as well as changed performance and makeup as the Hunchback. Chaney was already known as a character actor, but this turned him into a full-fledged Hollywood star. And it started something as well in the movement that horror films could be big box office. The big step after Hunchback of Notre Dame was the 1925 version of The Phantom of the Opera. Directed by Rupert Julian and again starring Chaney Sr., it's the Chaney Sr. in the title role of the deformed phantom who haunts the Paris Opera House. And obviously he causes mayhem and murder in an attempt to make the woman he loves a star. It probably is Chaney Sr.'s most famous role, and famous still now for its iconic self-devised makeup, which was kept a studio secret until the film's premiere. There were production problems and lukewarm reviews. New York Times said it was good for spectacle and particularly its amazing sets, but felt the story and acting might have been improved. And Time praised the sets, but felt the picture overall was only pretty good. Despite that, the film made another massive success, grossing over $2 million. Now, what these two films did was launch the Universal Monsters machine, which created some of the most iconic monsters of the cinema. The films were lush and extravagant productions. The interior of the Opera Grana for the Phantom of the Opera was recreated to scale, and it was used again for the 1943 remake with Claude Rains, as well as many other pictures. Before we jump over to what begins the start of Universal's real golden patch for Universal Monsters, it's also worth mentioning, although sadly we can never see, London After Midnight, also known as The Hypnotist, from 1927. It was written and directed by Todd Browning and now appears to be lost. The last known copy was destroyed in the 1967 MGM vault fire. And in 2002, Turner Classic Movies aired a reconstructed version using the original script and movie stills. Again, it's known really for Lon Chaney's incredible makeup as this monster. And again, once again, as we're saying, is sadly lost to us. Lon Chaney Sr., died in 1930, and Universal turned their attention to other actors. These included the German character actor Conrad Veidt, who appeared in Captain Dr. Caligari, and starred in the 1928 Universal horror film The Man That Laughs. Despite the Great Depression, Carl Laramie Jr. produced massive successes for the studio, with two films, both now iconic. Dracula, which directed by Todd Browning, who we've just mentioned for London After Midnight, and Frankenstein, directed by James Whale. Now, both these films came out in 1931. Dracula is an interesting film, really. The film's like dramatics from stage play were reflecting the special effects, so we get fog and lightning flecks, lightning bolts, done with like flashes basically, and large ridiculous bats. So Dracula, when he transitions himself from bat to person, is done off camera, and the film employs extended periods of silence and character close-ups for dramatic effect. There are in fact intertitles and close-ups of newspaper articles to advance the story. All of these are holdovers from silent film. And indeed, a lot of the performance is based on the silent era, or feels like it anyway. See, Todd Browning had a great reputation as a silent film director, having made them since 1915, but he never really came across as being at ease with sound films, and only directed a few more in 1939. When the film premiered at the Roxy Theatre in New York on February 12, 1931, and 2 days later throughout the US, newspapers reported that members of the audience fainted in shock at the horror on screen. This publicity, no doubt orchestrated by the film studio, helped ensure people came to see the film, if for no other reason than curiosity. Dracula actually was a big gamble for the Hollywood studio system to take. In spite of its literary credentials, of the source material, and the fact that it was so well known, it was uncertain if any American audience would be prepared to seriously sit through a full-length supernatural chiller, though America had been exposed to some such in the past with The Cat and the Canary. This was a horror film that had no comic relief or trick ending that downplayed the supernatural elements. So, executives no doubt breathed a collective sigh of relief when Dracula proved to be a huge box office sensation. Within 48 hours of its opening at New York's Roxy, it sold 50,000 tickets. As we've said though, Browning struggled with the transition to talkies, and this is a very stagey production. It was a difficult time for cinema as they tried to adapt to the sound on film, and Dracula was filmed as also not just a talkie but as a silent production as well for cinemas that hadn't put in a sound system. There was also a Spanish language version, which is common for the Hollywood system to produce foreign language versions of their films, usually Spanish but also in French, Italian and German, using the same sets and costumes. Of the cast, Carlos Villarreal playing Dracula was the only person who was allowed to see rushes of the English language film starring Bela Lugosi. I was encouraged to imitate the other man's performance, as well some long shots of Lugosi's account, as well as some alternative takes from the English version were used in the production. Now, this Spanish version is now actually seen as being almost superior to the English language. The Spanish crew allegedly desperately looked at the English dailies and tried to figure out how to better the work of Todd Browning, and in fairness, probably not that hard a challenge considering how much of a struggle he was making filming the film at all. So it has its supporters, definitely. Although what it doesn't have is such a strong lead with Bela Lugosi. Now, Lugosi effectively had created what we would now could see the quintessential Dracula. The long fingers and the cape, The Widow's Peak. You know, everything from lots of romanticized images of that version, right the way through to probably, you know, Chocula, you know, the breakfast cereal. It's all based on Bela Lugosi's performance, really.
I am Dracula. Oh, it's really good to see you. I don't know what happened to the driver and my luggage and... Well, and with all this, I thought I was in the wrong place.
I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
I mean, he was a Hungarian-American actor, and he was haunted, really, by making such a monumental and quite iconic role. He wasn't as able to snap out of it as this person, actually, Boris Karloff. Now, Karloff played Frankenstein in the 1931 version, which also came out, which we've mentioned already, which is adapted again from a play by Peggy Webling. It came out immediately following the success of Dracula. Now, Lugosi had been first choice to play Dr. Frankenstein in Universal's original film concept, but the actor was unsuitable for that role. He was then downgraded to play the monster, a common move for a contract player in a film studio at the time. And although this was a downgrade, it would even be more so because the plan was and is in that film not to credit the monster at all, which is something that was a freak was done on the stage at the time as well, and was kind of seen as being a little bit of a conceit to the mystery. Makeup tests allegedly though were disastrous, and the ghost was apparently meant to look more like Paul Wagner in The Golem, which no doubt would have appeared to be a huge step backwards for them. So Lugosi left. Now, it's seen as being a terrible situation for him because he'd made a mistake in terms of leaving this production, because in the fact that Frankenstein became so iconic. But it's worth pointing out that the role that Karloff took over is very different to the Ghosties version in that script from that play. Made him like a killing machine, basically, without any human interest or pathos. Apparently it caused Lugosi to complain, "I was a star in my country and I will be a scarecrow over here." Apparently, according to Robert Flory, who had written some of the script, and he has an uncredited role in that in screenwriting, he says that the Hungarian actor didn't show himself very enthusiastic for the role and didn't want to play it. Flory was down to direct at the time, and he got kicked off the project when James Whale asked for it, basically. Whales had come from England by Universal, given a free hand in the choice of projects he wanted. He wanted to do Frankenstein and then completely revise the script and the conception of the project, which initially had troubled the management. Flory and Lugosi, for their woes, were given Murders on the Rue Morgue. And to be fair, Lugosi would go on to play Frankenstein in the lesser film Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman a decade later, when his career was on the decline, and only after Lon Chaney Jr. replaced to play both the Wolfman and the monster in the film for the same pay rate. Chaney had already appeared as the monster, actually, in Ghost of Frankenstein, but we'll talk about that in a bit. Variety loved this version of the story, reporting that Dracula, it looks like a Dracula plus, touching a new peak in horror plays, and described Karloff's performance as a fascinating acting bit of mesmerism. Its review also singled out the look of the film as uniquely praiseworthy, calling the photography splendid, and the lighting the last word in ingenuity. since much of the footage calls for dim or night effect and the manipulation of shadows to intensify the ghosting atmosphere. Now, if you're wondering where that sounds familiar from, of course it is the influence of our friends over in Germany with their own German expressionism, something that influenced Wales when he created this film.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
It's Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children. This is the story you've heard about, talked about. The spine-tingling, blood-chilling story that stuns your emotions. Frankenstein.
Don't touch that!
Todd Browning, after Dracula, went over to MGM and created Freaks from 1932, where the eponymous characters were played by people who worked at carnival sideshows, the people with real deformities. The original version was getting too shocking to be released and no longer exists. It was directed and produced by Browning, whose career never recovered from the damage it caused. Freaks has been described as standing alone in a subgenre of one. It came from actually when he was 16. He left his well-to-do family to join a traveling circus, and during his personal experiences for Freaks, because of his success as the director of Frank Dracula, he was given considerable leeway for a major studio's first horror film for MGM. And the fact he was working in pre-code Hollywood enabled what was a unique production. It's fair to say, though, although this obviously is rooted in exploitation, the film actually gives our freaks, makes them trusting and honourable people, and the real monsters are the two normal members of the circus who conspire to murder one of the performers to obtain a large inheritance. Despite the cuts to make it more acceptable and palatable, the film was still negatively received and recorded a loss of $164,000. And it still was, for a long time, extremely controversial. Brown had trouble finding work because he lost so much money. And indeed, the controversy meant that the film was thought to be overly exploitative and was banned in the UK for 30 years. It's fair to say, particularly with Freaks, that, and in this kind of, it's one of the first, you know, there were exploitation films already, but it was certainly one of the more notable ones. And in fact, that was reflected in the reviews. Harrison's reports wrote that anyone who considers this entertainment should be placed in the pathological ward in some hospital. And the Kansas City Star wrote, "There is no excuse for this picture. It took a weak mind to produce it, and it takes a strong stomach to look at it." The Hollywood Reporter polishes this up with a claim that this is an outrageous onslaught upon the feelings, the senses, the brains, and the stomachs of the audience.
We didn't lie to you, folks. We told you we had living, breathing monstrosities. You laughed at them, shuddered at them, and yet, but for the accident of birth, you might be even as they are. They did not ask to be brought into the world, but into the world they came. Their code is a law unto themselves. Offend one, and you offend them all. And now, folks, if you'll just step this way, you are about to witness the most amazing, the most astounding living monstrosity of all time.
Soprano leaves the picture of horror, and it is harsh, really, because he had a number of fantastic films there. The Phantom of the Opera, the lesser but still iconic Dracula, and the deeply misunderstood Freaks. Meanwhile, though, the success of Dracula and Frankenstein launches Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff's careers and ushered them to a whole new genre of American cinema, with Universal sitting right at the forefront. Filmmakers would build on the success of these two movies and create a large range of films. And these films provided steady work for a number of genre actors too, including John Carradine, and other regular talents such as Jack Pierce and Bud Westmore, who created plenty of the makeup effects that we see, and the composers Hans J. Salter and Frank Skinner. Many of horror genre's well-known conventions and, dare I say now, cliches came from this period. The creaking staircases, cobwebs, the swirling mists, and of course our peasants with pitchforks that is so routinely spoofed by The Simpsons now. The thing about between the two, though, is there is a difference. Dracula is a monster in search of a woman, whereas Frankenstein is a misunderstood character who falls apart to the braying mob. By the time we reach The Mummy, starring Karloff in 1932, things have improved and Universal are looking more, not just in terms of horror, and indeed because of the incoming production code, but also more like gothic romance. The Mummy is notable for being a character who is really after the woman he loves, but is willing to sacrifice others for that to happen. Now that's something obviously that sits within 1925's The Phantom of the Opera, but it's far more pronounced now, and indeed our monsters are less quite so monstery or monstrous, but more kind of people, men at the end of the limits, doing terrible things. Edgar Allan Poe's Murder of the Rue Morgue, we've already mentioned, starring Lugosi. There was The Black Cat and The Raven, which teamed Lugosi with Karloff. The Invisible Man in 1933 is very noticeable for its special effects, starring Claude Rains. And indeed, although you don't see much of him, it kind of launched his career as being spectacular in many ways. From here we see very much money being and set design moving aside almost for special effects. Indeed, in The Invisible Man is so special effects heavy in terms of its of how it works, that many people kind of still hold it up as being, you know, more of an effects movie than a horror film. Now, of all the Universal monsters, though, it is the iconic nature of Frankenstein which is the most successful and indeed sequelized. So you've got Bride of Frankenstein in 1935. Now, Dracula has its fair share of sequels too, beginning with Dracula's Daughter in 1936. Although, by the time we reach the 40s, horror and romantic and gothic horror has been completely replaced by comedy, with the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein film that kind of sets into action a number of silly farce-like films, like a Laurel and Hardy kind of thing, rather than anything more than that. but we're getting ahead of ourselves, really. The reality is that the Universal Monsters period kind of comes in gluts when Universal realizes you can make loads of money out of these films. So the first run actually ends in 1936, when the LaMills were forced out of the studio system after financial difficulties and a series of box office flops, partly due to a temporary ban on American horror films in Britain in the wake of MGM's Mad Love and The Raven, both from 1935. Now, Mad Love is an American horror film adapted by Maurice Renard's story, The Hands of Orlok. And it's Karl Frudes, who's a German director's film, and stars Peter Lorre as Dr. Gogol. Plot revolves around this doctor's obsession with his actress, Yvonne Orlok. When Stephen Orlok's hands are destroyed in a train accident, Yvonne brings him to Gogol, who claims to be able to repair them. As Gogol becomes obsessed to the point he'll do anything to have Yvonne, Stephen finds his new hands have made him into an expert knife thrower. After the initial release, MGM had to cut 15 minutes of scenes from the film, including scenes to surgery to get Rollo's hands, a pre-credit warning scene similar to the one of Frankenstein, and Isabel Jules' entire portrayal of a character called Marianne, which was seen as too sexual.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Peter Lorre speaking.
I couldn't resist the temptation to call you. I just read of your new picture that you're to make.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thanks for your interest.
Oh, I thought you were magnificent in M.
And just the other night I saw your new picture, The Man Who Knew Too Much.
What character are you going to play in?
Oh, it's the most unusual story. You know, it's a great love drama. I am to be a half-mad scientist. I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love? He shall be shut up when it's I who am mad. But nobody knows that. Yes. Each man kills the thing he loves.
Monster Movies would drop from the production schedule from Universal and would not re-emerge for another 3 years. So how did Universal realise that there was value and worth in it? Well, in the meantime, theatre owner revived the Dracula and Frankenstein as a double bill and actually became an immediate smash hit, leading to original movies being re-released by the studio system to surprising success. This was our first classic horror double bill, something that we'll have to speak about later on as we move closer. In the UK, late night TV showed things like Dracula and Frankenstein on a Friday night, Saturday night. Introduced a generation to these kind of horror monsters. In America, on cheap cable TV, they also kind of was relaunched into the public consensus later, further down the line, with horror hosts such as Vampira. But here there was a realization from Universal of two things. One is that there's an appetite for these films, and two, they weren't making any money out of these prints anymore. So What happened was they greenlit and gave the go-ahead for Son of Frankenstein in 1939, starring Basil Rathbone, who's probably better known in the UK for his portrayal as Sherlock Holmes, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. Now, 13 of the 17 1930s Universal horrors starred either Lugosi or Karloff or both. Now, there was this new rash of films. Now, during the 1940s, the most successful in the new series of these films was The Wolfman in 1941, which established the actor Lon Chaney Jr., our man Lon Chaney Sr.'s son. He was a leading horror actor role and literally followed in his father's footsteps. In 1943, again, with this, makeup was a huge part for Chaney and kind of catapulted that role. In 1943, the studio created a remake of The Phantom of the Opera, starring Nelson Eddy. And in that film was as much a musical as a horror, and Claude Rains stars the Phantom. Already, once again, we see this change from horror to a diversification in terms of what they try and offer. Now, a lot of the reason for that is that they were pumping out so many horror films. But still, always at the heart, they are sold on the concept of the monster. Now, in the future, we're going to talk about, you know, the slasher films of the 70s and 80s, your Freddy Kruegers and Jason and Cropsey from The Burn and all sorts of these kind of slasher monsters. The killing machine, in truth, that we were talking about with Bela Lugosi's version of Frankenstein might have been. But here there is always more to it. There's always slight more gothic romance and more reasoning. Our monsters are far more complicated in their character form than just kills. Now, part of the reason for that was there was more censorship, so we couldn't have as much of a violence kind of monster. Now, Frankenstein and Wolfman effectively went off a cliff in terms of quality, and it became B-films, really. Ghost of Frankenstein in 1942, which had Lon Chaney Jr. playing the monster. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman in 1943, which we've already mentioned had Lugosi as the monster and Chaney Jr. as the Wolfman. Son of Dracula, being Chaney Jr. in Lugosi's role as the Count. The Mummy series continued with The Mummy's Hand and The Mummy's Tomb. And then finally, in that kind of lore of diminishing returns, all of Universal's monsters except The Mummy and The Invisible Man were brought together in House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula. By the time the decade grew to a close, we were already in the realms of comedy. Now, the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein actually was a huge hit for the studio, though. And they realised there was money to be made from making silly versions. Now, Chaney Jr. only started in acting after his father's death and took a bit part in the film called Girl Crazy in 1932. He appeared in films under his real name until 1935, when he began to be billed as Lon Chaney Jr. 1942 onwards, he was billed as Lon Chaney, although the Jr. was usually added by others when referred to him to distinguish him from his frankly more famous father, who he did resemble. Chaney actually, before becoming sucked into the Universal Monster Machine, did have a critical acclaim with a version of Mice and Men from 1939, where he played Lenny. He'd already been asked to test for Quasimodo, but it was that their role actually went to Charles Laughton. With 1 million BC in 1940, his third build character role, he became seen as a character actor in the version of his father, and he had in fact designed a ape-like Neanderthal makeup for himself for the production. Although he wanted to do that, union rules prevented him from. He signed up to Universal in 1941, and where he was in Man-Made Monster, which is a sci-fi horror really. Originally it was for Karloff. Then The Wolfman, and then that was it. He was typecast as a horror film actor for the rest of his life. but he appeared in lots of different films, as we've already mentioned. Not just Wolfman, but also Dracula and as Frankenstein. He liked playing the villain, though. He was a big lad, 6'2" and 220 pounds. So he could appear in things like I Died a Thousand Times and The Indestructible Man, playing supporting roles and the bad guy. He made 30 films for Universal, and then left the studio and worked primarily in character roles, and it appeared in High Noon and Casanova's Big Night. Famously, he appeared in the live television version of Frankenstein on the Tales of Tomorrow anthology show. He's alleged to have shown up quite drunk, although that is unsubstantiated. During the performance, though, Chaney played the monster, thought it was just a rehearsal. He picked up furniture that was supposed to break, only to gingerly put it back down while muttering, "I saved it for you." By the 50s, Universal had stopped filming most of its original line of horror characters, with Frankenstein's monster, Dracula and the Wolfman, having been retired with Albert and the Costello film in 1948. Albert and Costello kept kind of interest in the monsters alive with films with The Mummy and The Invisible Man, and in 1954, the horror films had returned in popularity. Again, just as trends come and go. Creature from the Black Lagoon is probably the last of the Universal films that are so notable and standalone. It revived Universal's horror franchise, certainly, and gave it a new generation of fans. Dracula and Frankenstein were chosen to be re-released as double features in many theatres, before eventually premiering on syndicated TV in 1957. As part of the Shock Theatre package of Universal Monster Movies, so it was basically on your local cable network.
What was it? Science didn't know, but dedicated scientists were willing to risk their lives to find out.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. This one was a failure. It hasn't changed in millions of years. But here we have a clue to an answer.
Starring Richard Carlson, grimly adventuring underwater in the depths of the mighty Amazon. Lovely Julia Adams, her beauty a lure even to the man-beast from the dawn of time. With Richard Denning, whose scientific passion turned to the fury of revenge. You'll see the most amazing underwater photography that the screen has ever known. In this strangest of all science fiction adventures.
Four men dead so far.
We're staying until we get him.
Or until somebody else gets killed.
Hammer also brought these stories back and sparked interest in what were seen as the original versions of these tales, even though obviously, for example, with Frankenstein, that story had been told before. And indeed, the reason why Hammer were able to do it is because they were, although if as long as they avoided the copyright elements of the makeup, they could use the out-of-copyright storylines. In the 50s, magazines such as the famous Monsters of Filmland would propel these movies into lasting infamy. And indeed, Universal spent the last half of the decade issuing a number of one-shot monster films. Between TV reissues and nostalgia, and things like the magazine Famous Monsters of Filmland, it kind of becomes a point where the films became constant in the minds of the public, and that is mainly due to the iconic makeup effects. Now, Hammer House of Horror revitalized all this. But we're going to look at that in a lot more closer detail next time. So, here we are, looking over a wide variety of rather stunning, iconic characters. I think the thing for me personally is so noticeable is you know, you can draw a direct line between 1925, probably through to roughly around the Wolfman. And, you know, indeed, even Creatures of the Black Lagoon kind of is like almost a throwback to that. Interestingly enough about Creatures from the Black Lagoon, it used a 3D feature to kind of grab and get its audiences in. We'll talk about that kind of stuff in, when we go, well, it pops up and down really. But in the 50s, 3D was seen as the saviour of TV, of cinema. When you know, when people are watching stuff at home, not too dissimilar to how it was seen a few years ago in the I think, but you know, that's interesting in itself. Okay, so I can't. We now have a period of time where we have iconic horror monster roles, and these icons of horror will sit and remain in the consciousness. It's certainly not the last time we're going to talk about horror icons, though, and I'm sure for a lot of you, you won't be that surprised at that. But for me, certainly Lugosi's Dracula and Karloff's Frankenstein are up there with our Michael Myers or our Jason Voorhees in terms of iconic horror. It's just steeped a little bit more in romance. Okay, just a bit of feedback. This from Scott P. Mr. Brown, it's a great pleasure to have you back after the fantastic Video Nasty set of podcasts. Heard the intro in the first episode, very informative and fun. I really like the new voice this podcast has. Very excited to see where it goes from here. Cheers, mate. Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much. For those who don't know, my podcast was about the Video Nasties. And I think I've kind of mentioned it before, and I am aware that this is very different in terms of what it's trying to achieve. But hopefully you're with me on the ride. And as I say, you know, like lots of things, you can tie the history. I mean, I'm trying to tie the history all together to get you an idea in terms of where stuff comes from. And also maybe to kind of, you know, I'm 100% sure that if you're into a certain period of time in the history of horror films, we're going to have an episode for you. Anyway. Another bit of feedback from Rob Wilson. Now, listeners to Video Nasties will remember Rob. He was incredibly forthright in terms of giving feedback, and was fantastic to hear his opinions, always written in and left in comments and emails, and wonderful stuff they were too. Always fascinated to give other opinions on the films. He said, "Hey Chris, love the show." True, Nosferatu is probably not scary to modern audiences. I must have been 4 or 5 and had an issue of Famous Monsters magazine that featured pictures from the movie. At 45, I can tell you that the images have stayed with me. I remember a picture of him in the shadow where his hand is extended. It looks like a tree branch. I assume that the creature could turn into a tree. That way children could walk right to him. Maybe 15 years back, I saw the film with an audience at the Music Box in Chicago. I doubt if anybody was frightened. Still, I think it's a great movie. I'm going to be out here listening. Thanks. Well, thank you, Rob, and it's lovely to hear you back and listening to us. It's lovely to hear back from a lot of listeners from the Video Nasties podcast. I didn't know how many people had carry over, in truth, because it's obviously so different, you know. As I was saying, it did feel like a very different experience when I put the first one out, and I was like, does this actually make sense just sitting on its own? And it probably didn't really. And I think once you kind of, you see it more of an overarching theme, it'll make a little bit more sense. Also, thanks to Wolf, who sent a lovely email and welcoming me back, and all the lovely tweets I've been receiving on Twitter, and as well, reviews on iTunes, which are very kind, very helpful, and really help get the word out as well. So thank you to Mr. Dubcraft, Leighton Rocks, and Nightstalker 5000. It's lovely to have you all on board, and thank you so for the very kind words. One more bit of feedback, listeners to some of my other work, Night Gallery podcast and Vision Nasties podcast, will know a guy called Tom Elliott, who is the Twilight Zone podcast host, which is a fantastic, wonderful podcast going through all the episodes of The Twilight Zone, and also The Strange and Deadly Show, which he works with Chris Clayton, and that is about what are called the Section 3 Video Nasties list, which are kind of like an additional list of films that were confiscated and by magistrates and destroyed by magistrates, and really varied selection of films. And that's a wonderful thing in itself, you know, to be able to talk about such a wide variety of film from a very particular period in time, early 80s video shop, basically. So that's fantastic. So let's have a listen to what he has to say.
Hi, Chris. I thought I would send you a bit of feedback about your upcoming Universal Monsters episode. You know, people who know me, people who know what I'm into from my other podcasts will kind of put me in with the, you know, the Grindhouse era, the 70s, the 80s kind of stuff. And that, for the most part, is true. But I did have a kind of dalliance with the Universal Monsters back in, I can't remember what year it was, but they brought out a really nice set, the Legacy Collection, I think it was called, with, you know, the three busts of the Wolfman, Dracula, and Frankenstein. So I really kind of immersed myself in that for a while. I'm sure you'll have covered those films a lot, but what really interests me about them is how, even back in those early days, how sequelized horror became, you know. What is it about horror that makes it so sequel kind of friendly? Now, I know there was other stuff too. I mean, the Tarzan series back in those days was, you know, putting out a lot of movies. There was probably other stuff that I'm not even aware of. But horror seemed to be instantly sequelizable, if that's even a word. I don't know. And it's remained that way ever since. You know, look at the 80s and the way that happened. And maybe not so much now, but then, you know, there's still occasionally a Paranormal Activity or a Saw series, that sort of thing. But it all started there with the Universal Monsters, and I think that's what interests me, you know, that monster mashup kind of thing. You know, they all started in their own series, and then they threw them all together, and it was all, you know, you could say the movies weren't as good, but they were still great fun. And, you know, Universal have recently brought out that new Dracula movie, and they're talking about, well, we're going to go Marvel Universe with these monsters and build a universe around them and mash them all up together. When really speaking, they're not going Marvel Universe on them, they're going Universal on them, because they started it in the first place. It was them who did this. So, you know, not much of a comment, but I think you're going to have covered probably a lot about the Universal Monsters, and that's kind of the thing that sticks with me about them. So anyway, thanks for the podcast, Chris. Great work as always, and I enjoy hearing where it's going to go from now on. I'll speak to you later.
Cheers for that, Tom. I think you're right. I think it is interesting. And, you know, for Universal, they did kind of, and because it made them so much money, they leapt at the concept almost immediately. I do wonder how successful a Universal world of monsters, like in a reborn kind of way, would work now. They're so iconic, but they're also seen as being quite dated. And, you know, I don't think people are particularly frightened by these kind of things anymore. They may have been when they were children, and that nostalgia remains over. But I mean, that Dracula Untold, it was, you know, more of an action movie, I suppose. But then again, as we've already said, you know, it kind of, they didn't restrict themselves to straight horror with the monsters. They went where they thought the interest would lie. So I absolutely agree, and I hadn't really considered it in that way before you mentioned it, that Universal, you know, created this kind of, you know, universal world, you know, where, you know, and where different monsters would meet each other and fight, you know, House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein. So I suppose that's, you know, that's the Avengers movie of this universe, isn't it? So thanks very much for that, Tom. That's great stuff. I think it's wonderful, like, you know, it's really brilliant having the feedback anyway, but I think it's really great to hear people's memories of film. I'm currently working on I help build a cinema in Liverpool. It's a community voluntary cinema, and it was like literally built with donations and found it. And one of the things we ask people to do who come is to write their memories of film. So I was thinking about that, and maybe if you'd like to, if anyone who's listening is interested, you don't have to, of course, but to write your own memories down. It doesn't have to be about the films we're talking about now, or if you want to, that's fantastic. But maybe the first film that made you frightened, or the first most scary thing. That for me would be wonderful. Anyway, basically what I'm asking for is, if you want to get in touch about horror films, please do. My email address is historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can go to the website, historyofhorrorpodcast.com, or you can get me on Twitter, which is @orange_monkey. Speaking of that that cinema, on April 30th, I'm going to be showing Todd Browning's Freaks as part of a monthly horror film screening. Now, if you go to liverpoolsmallcinema.org.uk, you'll be able to get all the details. Freaks is £5 a ticket and £4 on concessions. And then the month afterwards, we're going to show The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, a classic video nasty too. So just go and check it out. And if you're in the Northwest and keen on seeing some old school horror, let us know and come down and see us. Now, I'm just looking at how long we've run so far, and we've gone over what I'd said I would do. So, there you go. But hopefully you've enjoyed it. I'm pretty sure when I last clips in here, this is going to be quite lengthy, actually. But, as I said, hope you enjoy. Take care. And I'll speak to you in 2 weeks' time about Hammer's House of Horror. Take care.